Okay, we're on Nehemiah chapter 4, his enemies. So for a quick review, we began with chapter 1 when we were introduced to Nehemiah. Nehemiah is an interesting fellow. What's his occupation? Cupbearer to whom?
King.
King who? Artaxerxes, and he is king of which empire? The Persian Empire. So we've got Nehemiah, who's located in Susa, which is the winter palace of the Persian Empire. He's the cupbearer to the king. Our story began when his brother Hanani had been in Jerusalem. He came back to Persia, and Nehemiah asked him how it was going in Jerusalem, because it's been how long since Babylon had come in and destroyed it? 140 years since Babylon had been there. Now, how long had it been since the first exiles had returned under Zerubbabel and Joshua? 90 years. Oh, you're doing well. Now, I'm going to keep asking you every week, and by the end of this, we'll have this down. My point in teaching is that I teach you the answers. You see, if I gave exams, everybody would get 100%. So, unfortunately, my professors don't do that. So, but I want to make sure everybody gets 100%. So it's been 140 years since Nebuchadnezzar has destroyed the walls of Jerusalem, 90 years since the first exiles had come back. And so now Nehemiah wants to know, how is it going? I mean, they've been back for 90 years. It ought to be doing great. The news that Hanani brought was not good. He said, they are in great trouble and disgrace. Why? Because the walls are still broken down and they've been burned with fire. And it touched Nehemiah's heart. He was just absolutely distraught. How could this be? And God laid on his heart that he should be the one to go back and rebuild the walls. And we talked about this. What did he handle on a daily basis? Fine things. Gold goblets, gold plates, because he was the one that tasted the king's wine and food to make sure it wasn't poison. He was asked to go back and do a heavy job. So he began praying and asking the Lord for an opportunity to speak to the king about this. Now, as I just said, this isn't something that he normally would do, but as he's praying, he's anticipating that if God answers this, I have to be prepared. So he's also making a plan. And how long did he have to pray before the Lord answered his prayer? 4 months. And on the fourth month, the king asked him why he was sad, and he said, because the city of my fathers is in ruins. And he says, well, what can I do to help? And because Nehemiah was prepared, he told him what. And we know that the Lord intervened, and he was allowed to return to Jerusalem. Not just return, but he was also given a role that he would go back and rebuild the walls. And finally, in next chapter, he's going to tell us that he goes as the governor. And who escorted him? The royal guards, the Persian guards. So, that was the end of chapter 1. In chapter 2, it opened up with Nehemiah coming into Jerusalem with this royal guard, and everybody noticed him, especially Sanballat and Tobiah. Boo. These are the enemies. But he didn't tell anybody exactly why he was back. In fact, he did an inspection of the walls at night. He wanted to see personally what the situation was. After all, he was going to be rebuilding the walls. And we remember that he was able to go out the valley gate, but he could only get as far as the fountain gate. The problem there was that the walls had so collapsed. This is the original wall that they were able to breach and break down there. And Solomon had built terraces out there. When they breached it, the whole thing collapsed. And he realized they would not be able to repair that wall. They had to completely rebuild. So then he came back into the city, and he then went to all the men of Judah, and he challenged them to come help him rebuild the wall. He says, this is the city that bears the name of the Lord, and it's in ruins. As soon as his plan was made known and word got out what he was going to do, what happened? Opposition. And Sanballat and Tobiah started harassing them. Chapter 3 then brought us the building project. And you remember he sent out word for volunteers. And who volunteered to rebuild the wall? Priests, perfumers, goldsmiths, and even the girls. So he had quite a workforce. We knew it was basically everyone. And we didn't talk about this, I don't think, but everybody was assigned a specific place, probably near either their home or where they worked, and everybody was working at the same time. So they would be spread out completely all around the wall. And then they set to work. And that's where our story left off. So we pick up again today with chapter 4 and the enemies. And we know that news travels very quickly, and Governor Sanballat and his friends found out that Nehemiah had come back as governor and that he was going to rebuild the wall. And when they heard, now I'm sorry about my questions. I know the group I was in had a hard time with them. You have to follow my logic. If there are bullets there and one thing up at the top, it means don't fill in all the answers, just fill in one or two words. So we'll finally figure it out when you follow my thinking here. But when he heard, indicating that they were not there, he called together his associates. Now, I want you to kind of go there with me. We know a little bit about Sanballat. He's the governor of Samaria, which is the nation just to the north of Judah, or the province now. Because keep in mind, even though these guys are governors, they're still all under the Persian Empire. And he was kind of hoping he'd be governor of Judah too, I think. So he calls together his associates and does what I call peacocking. Have you ever seen peacocks? You know, they're kind of thin birds until they get real puffed up, you know, and then all their feathers spread out. And have you ever heard them? I mean, they're noisy things, but they get your attention. And I think that's what Sanballat was doing. I think he was peacocking. He was strutting in front of his friends saying, look at me, I'm the big cheese, and, you know, they're not going to be able to do anything. First off, he parades his army out. The whole of the Samaritan army comes along, and he says, now see how big I am. Look at my army. And then he starts with a series of questions directed at specific things. He starts out, what are those feeble Jews doing? This is interesting because feeble refers to a sexual term for impotence. What was Nehemiah? You're going right to it. He was the cupbearer. He came in the presence of the queen in the harem. So what was he probably? He was probably a eunuch. So what's he saying? Okay, you got this guy leading your building project, right? What are these feeble Jews thinking? And he says, will they restore the walls? So first he attacks Nehemiah, then he attacks the people. He says, are these perfumers and girls and priests going to feel? I mean, after all, this is not a do-it-yourself job. This is a tough job. We're building with stones. We need masons here. And then he goes, will they offer sacrifices? Now, you remember that when the priest Eliashib was the first one in our overview, he also dedicated the wall. We didn't talk about that much. And they always did that just like we'd have a groundbreaking. But he's probably saying, are they going to pray up the walls? I mean, after all, Nehemiah's always praying. Maybe he can just pray them up. Or are they going to actually get them down and offering sacrifices? I mean, come on, look at their workforce. How are they going to be able to do this? And then he says, are they going to finish in a day? I mean, these people have no idea what they're getting into. And finally, he attacks the stones. He says, now, these stones, will they be brought back to life? Jerusalem stone is limestone. And if you burn limestone, it becomes fragile. And if you try to stack it up, it'll break. But the thing is, there's so much stone there, that's not a problem at all. So there was plenty of them. He was just peacocking. And now next to him, Tobiah pipes up. This is his cohort here. And he says, well, don't you know, even if a little fox goes up there, that's going to be so feeble that it'll just break all down. I mean, after all, they're not going to be able to do it. Well, as you know, the whole purpose of peacocking is to make sure somebody knows about it. So what happens? Word gets back to Nehemiah. And what's Nehemiah's response? What's Nehemiah's first response? He always prays. Now, interesting prayer. He says, hear us, O Lord, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over to plunder and the lamb of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders. Anybody have a problem with that prayer? What's Nehemiah asking? Revenge. Go get them, God. Now, this is in the Bible. Have you ever seen prayers and psalms in the Bible that ask God to take vengeance on their enemies? David does that a lot in his psalms. Now, Jesus tells us where to pray for our enemies, right? I'd like to spend some time here just a minute because the Old Testament does contain many of these. And without justifying him or judging him, I'd like to explain a little bit what's going on. First off, they have a name. They're called imprecatory. You don't have to remember the name unless you're going to take my tests. But I want you to understand the purpose of these imprecatory prayers and psalms are. First off, they're a way of verbalizing the anger to God. Do you think God knew what Nehemiah was feeling? So he's not telling God anything new. He's basically saying, I don't like this, God. This really makes me angry, and I want you to deal with this, guys, because of it. What it does is it helps harness anger and express it properly to God. Usually it's exaggerated. And what does it do? It directs the anger to and through God rather than acting out the anger. So what did Nehemiah do? He was mad. But he took that anger to the Lord and not out on Sanballat and Tobiah. And that's the purpose of these imprecatory psalms and prayers. It's to direct it to the Lord and then allow him to deal with it. Now, I want to go one step further because as New Testament people, Jesus says we are to love our enemies, but the importance is to understand what love means. We tend to think love means a warm feeling. You know, we're to feel emotional. Love is to do. Love means how you treat someone. You don't have to feel warm and fuzzy towards them, but you don't do them harm. You do them good. For those of you that are interested in this, this is a great book, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth by Fee and Stewart. So I want us to focus not so much on what he said as to maybe some of the reasons why he could do this. Think about this. Who had touched Nehemiah's heart to go rebuild the wall? The Lord had. This is God's city. He's doing what God called him to do. So by attacking Nehemiah and the Jews, they're really attacking the Lord and his plan. So Nehemiah says, they're not just attacking me, Lord. It's you they're really against. He also had, he meaning the Lord, had also pronounced judgment against those who came against Israel. Remember all the prophets before the enemies came in and destroyed it? Nehemiah is basically saying, God, protect your city, deliver it from the enemy. And then if you go all the way back to Genesis, what was the promise to Abraham? I will bless those who bless you and curse those that curse you. In other words, he's saying in Nike's slogan, God, do it. You said you were going to do it. Now, this is a good time. Do it. Now, what I want you to notice is after Nehemiah prayed what he did, he poured out his anger to the Lord. And he gave the problem to the Lord. And then he left it there. And he went back to work. And that's the point of it, is not to act on the anger, but to give it to the Lord. The result was not only Nehemiah was strengthened, but so were the builders. And they built with renewed heart. In fact, what happened to the wall? What was the next thing recorded? It was all joined together and it was half its height all of a sudden. Even though the opposition had not changed, their focus had. Well, word sped out very quickly, and Tobiah and Sanballat found out that that didn't work. They were still building, so they got reinforcements. Did you notice who they got reinforcements with? We got Sanballat and Tobiah and the Ammonites, and we got Geshem. He's the what? The Arab, and he controlled these areas. And then they added the Ashdodites. Notice? You notice anything about Judah? They're kind of surrounded. Does anybody remember Ashdod was one of five capital cities of what nation?
Philistines.
The Philistines, right. But now everybody's under the control of the Persian Empire. So they surrounded Judah because they have the most to lose if this city gets strong again. And we have our next word, but. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs of Jerusalem wall had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. The taunts didn't work, so then now they step up. They start leaking out plots of attack. What are they going to do? They're going to get fear and panic going for the people. What was the whole purpose of all the words and all the plots? To stop the building. Now, Nehemiah knows this. They probably aren't going to attack, because if these governors, who do they work for? King who? Artaxerxes, who's the Persian. Okay, so they're governors. They're not kings. They're not independent. They're all provinces. Imagine if all the governors came together against another governor. Who do you think would come against them? Probably the king and his army. So Nehemiah's thinking they're probably not going to do it. After all, Nehemiah was sent there as governor with authorization to do what? Rebuild the wall. So he's got every right to do it. So these guys are really just peacocking. But these are God's people, and he's not about to take a chance. So once again, we find him going to prayer and posting a guard. I love that. Prayer and posting the guard. He gives the problem to the Lord and says, you're going to have to deal with this. In the meantime, I'm going to protect my people and do what I have to do, but I'm going to still go back to work. And he uses what we call common sense. Now, what happens next, we can't see in English. But in verse 10, what we have is not recognizable in English, but in Hebrew, it's song or rhyme. It has a 3-2 beat to it. If you think about the military when they march, they use a rhythm, they chant as they walk along. Well, that's kind of what they were doing in order to keep them moving forward in the building. And what they were saying was, the strength of the laborers is giving out. There is so much rubble, we cannot rebuild the wall. So what they're chanting is not a positive thing to keep them moving forward, but actually focusing on the problem. There's so much to do, we can't possibly do it. We're getting tired. And the enemy heard. And they were encouraged. So what do? They step up their attacks. They say, you better watch out, because we're going to have a surprise attack. The enemy's going to come and he's going to kill the workers when they aren't looking. Now, the text isn't clear on this, but it seems to be applying to workers who are on the wall and not the general population. Sometime when we were reading it in the groups, they were saying, well, the outlying people were going to be killed and that would affect the work on the wall. That's probably not it, because these Persian officials would not probably attack innocent Jews in outlying areas, because if they did, again, they would risk the Persian army coming in to deal with them, and they would lose. So this isn't probably what they were referring to. They were threatening to come in and destroy the workers who were working on the wall. But remember, this is all a war of words. Chances are they're not going to do this anyway, but it's meant to discourage them enough to stop. Again, the text tells us that they were told this 10 times over. This is a way of saying again and again and again they were coming to him. Well, who were these informants? They were probably the ones who lived on the borders up there by Tobiah and by Sanballat. They were hearing what was going on. And what would you do if you had heard that somebody that you love might possibly be attacked and killed? Well, they did the normal thing. They ran to their loved ones on the walls and said, you've got to come home. You've got to stop this, because they're going to come and attack you and kill you, and we don't want that to happen. Again, the whole purpose of this war of words was in order to get them to stop work. The enemy was hoping that fear and panic would set in, and you know when you start focusing on fear that you're debilitated and you can't continue. And it seems very well to be working. Nehemiah knows at this point that he's about to face a mass desertion unless he can assure the people that they are safe, because the Lord is protecting him. So he steps up security. This time he stations guards at strategic locations. He placed them where they could be seen from outside the wall. It's at the low point. So the wall now is joined together, but it's higher in some places and lower in other places. And so what does he do? He stands the military guard, probably his own Persian guards, at the low places, looking out, always constantly on the lookout. That way, if you were an enemy and you came by, you would think, oh, they're all the way the inside of the perimeter of the wall. Notice he also kept all the families together. They were working together on the wall, and of course you would be concerned from one another. You would also be a good fighting unit together, because you would protect your own. There's another thing that came up in one of the groups this morning that was also kind of interesting. Guys that are in the military said it would be easy to tell an enemy if you were by families, because if anybody you didn't recognize was coming in, you would spot them immediately. So Nehemiah was using all different types of tactics that would be helpful for the family. He also encourages them all to keep weapons by their sides. important. These weapons are not military weapons. They're mostly hunting weapons. But what did it do? It gave the people a sense of security, a sense that we can protect ourselves. And the result was that it boosted the morale. Well, as sunset approached, Nehemiah rallied all the troops together for what I'd call a pep talk. He got them to focus off the problem and back on the Lord. He used words reminiscent of Joshua's battle cries. Listen to him. Don't be afraid. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. Fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. And then he made sure word got back to Sanballat and friends that their plot would not work. No surprise attack, because the Lord had revealed to them his plans. Well, with renewed commitment and energy, then the people went back to work. But Nehemiah continued to put further defenses in. So far, they had only threatened them with words, but in desperation, may they actually try a physical attack. He couldn't afford any further morale problems, so he used the military formations of old. Go back to Joshua's days when Israel was threatened. Everybody was to be in a state of constant readiness. Men who had accompanied Nehemiah to Judah and served under him as governor were now part of the building crew, but he pulled them off and had them stand guard. They would be prepared for military battle. He divided the workforce into two teams, half guarded while the other half worked. And it was interesting because if you think about the workforce, now if you're working on the wall, you have to have two hands to work. So these guys were to keep a weapon at their side. If you're working on the wall, you have a weapon close by. But if you had to go outside for water or for any other reason, you only need one hand, because if you think about how they carried water and stuff, quite often it was on their heads. And if you see them, they put their hand up there to hold the pot. Well, that way you would have another hand free to hold a weapon. And then if you were on guard, you would have two hands with weapons. So everybody would be constantly in a state of readiness. He also, at this second meeting, said that everybody was now supposed to stay in the city at night. They would no longer be allowed to return to their homes. No more commute time. That would speed up the building process, but it would also protect the people and the city. Now, there's another point there that he said they were all spread out. In fact, they were spread over a mile and a half. That was the perimeter of the wall. He put into effect the old signaling method of a trumpeter. The trumpeter would blast, and they would know that there was danger coming. He was to remain with Nehemiah all the time as he moved among the workers. And then if there was any danger, they would all rally from all over the wall to that place. Now, we know the Bible is selective history. It doesn't give us all the information we need. But Josephus tells us that they also posted other rally trumpeters along the wall every 500 feet. That way they would pass along the signal, and those signals would tell them where to rally. Now, the horn is a shofar, a ram's horn. So if you've ever heard one, they're not really very loud. But it would be able to be heard far enough that they would all know and rally around it. Well, we come to the last verse, 23 of chapter 4, and this is often used as, again, looking at Nehemiah as a role model for a godly leader, especially in difficult situations, because Nehemiah is what we call a servant leader. He led by example. He was always right there with his people in the trenches, whether awake or asleep. He and his men were always on duty. It said that he didn't even take his clothes off. That means not that he didn't take them off to wash it, like some people thought, or that he was very smelly, which is probably true, but he did not take it off, go into a house and rest, but that he stayed right there with the people. He was always there. He would never ask them to do anything that he was not willing to do himself. Well, in closing today, let's go look back over his leadership style in this chapter. What I found fascinating was that each time he was threatened by the enemy, instead of diverting his energy or his resources, he turned it to his advantage. Let's look at some of these. Nehemiah's first line of defense was always to pray and to come before the Lord first. But the enemy wanted him to stop work, so what did he do? He extended the workday from sunup to sundown. They wanted to discourage and drive the morale through the floor, but instead of letting morale drop, he added military support, which encouraged it. Panic is supposed to drain your energy, but instead of draining their energy, he focused off the problem and back on the Lord. And what happened? He renewed their strength and renewed the energy. The other interesting thing is that Nehemiah never blamed anyone, but always confronted the problem head on. Think about it. When it came externally from Sanballat and Tobiah, he prepared the people and he posted guards. When it came internally from their fear and their panic, he focused their attention off the problem, back onto the Lord, reminding them that the Lord is the one who will fight for you. And he was able to turn their fear into faith. So if I could sum up what I know about Nehemiah now and his leadership style, I would say that Nehemiah was faith in action. He constantly combined prayer with preparation, planning, and action. Well, how can we apply that to our lives? One of the things I noticed is that my life personally is full of conflict. It comes externally in the form of pressures from people, from events, from things that are beyond my control, but it also comes from internal. Sometimes I get my focus on the problem and then fear and panic sets into my life and I am unable to do things as well. If I could put it in a little form here, I would suggest that Nehemiah says the first thing we do is pray. And while we're praying, we're also not inactive. We plan and prepare, but we always wait on the Lord for His timing. The next thing we need to do is leave it there. Nehemiah didn't carry the weight. He gave it to the Lord, and then he went back to work and trusted the Lord to deal with the problem. You know, I don't tend to be very good at that. Now, I can bring my problems to the Lord in prayer, and I liken it to a backpack. You know, I'm going along, and I'm carrying this heavy pack with rocks on it, and I'll go to the Lord, and I'll unload all those rocks and give them to him, but then I'll walk away, and I'll feel just as heavy, and as I look at my backpack, I'll realize that I took my problem right back with me. So I have a new model. I am going to refuse to be discouraged. And so I say to myself, don't go there. Every time the thought keeps coming back where I am focusing on the problem, I'll say to myself, don't go there. You've committed it to the Lord. Leave it there. But have you ever noticed that when something is taken out of your life, particularly if you're dieting and you say, I'm not going to eat that anymore, that all the more you focus on it? Well, what we need to do is put something in the place of something you removed. So when I take the problem and give it back to the Lord, then I need to refocus on the Lord, put Him in that place. That way I'm not thinking about the problem, but I'm focusing on the Lord, His faithfulness and His strength. The other thing that Nehemiah did after he gave the problem to the Lord was he went back to work doing what God had called him to do, what he knew was right, while he waited on the Lord's next direction of what he should do. And I think that's just a really good example for us.